This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. In 1979, Iranian university students stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. The incident sparked the Iran hostage crisis, in which 52 American diplomats and citizens were taken hostage for 444 days. About 3 months after the embassy takeover, photojournalist Randy Goodman traveled to Iran. She was part of a delegation to learn more about why students overtook the embassy. Goodman recently returned to Iran to see how the country has changed. Her most recent visit resulted in a photography exhibit entitled Iran, Women Only. Randy Goodman spoke with my colleague, Rebecca Cruz.
Randy Goodman, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you, Rebecca.
You came to international fame during the aftermath of the Iran hostage situation and took a number of wonderful pictures there. You have since had a full career, have returned to Boston, and unfortunately or fortunately took a number of really striking pictures of the Boston Marathon bombing as well. So many historical events that you have been there and photographed. But I wanted to go back a little bit and talk about your initial interest in photography. Is this something that you were interested in from the very beginning? Do you recall being a child and looking at things and wanting to capture them?
Oh, nice way to start the conversation, Rebecca. Thank you. My interest in photography really stemmed from the training and therefore my passion of doing political work and being a political sociologist. I had always been involved in community organizing and used photography as a tool for teaching. So in 1980, when a colleague of mine was asked to go over to Iran to meet with the people holding the hostages, he said to me, "Would you like to come along and be the photographer?" Well, how phenomenal an opportunity is that, and what experience for on-the-job training. I said, sure, and I picked up my camera, put on my hat as now an international photojournalist, and launched what became, you know, an extraordinarily interesting career covering Iran, Cuba, Nicaragua, all as a freelancer. You know, there were a lot of people out there for hire, but, you know, that's how sometimes things go.
And when you're taking an amazing photograph, do you know as you're taking that shot that it's going to be just that beautiful, wonderful story, or that it's going to speak volumes, or do you have that instinct?
Oh, I wish I could say yes 1,000 times. But we're only human beings. Sometimes, yes. I mean, when you're covering something, you just can't wait to get that picture out of your camera and show others and make sure that it does get kind of representation of what that event was. Other times, you're taking so many so quickly that it's just an experience like no other. And afterwards, you have to go back and recap and see really which one stands out, which one tells the story, what composite of elements ends up being, you know, the photograph. And that can be a very complicated experience sometimes.
I'm sure it's full of surprises too when you're going through the film and, oh, that one was perfect, or that one didn't turn out as I suspected.
Right. Those are the ones you try to put away and not let your editors see.
Absolutely. Well, as you said, you found yourself in Tehran, in Iran, really right after or during the hostage situation. And it sounds like an interesting story that things just kind of happened and you found yourself there. You were not much older than the students involved in the hostage situation.
Exactly. Yeah. I was 24 years old, and the students who had taken over the embassy were from the local 5 universities in Tehran, and they were aged 18 to 22. So while this delegation visit that I was covering, where I'd say most everyone was at least 10 to 15 to 20 years older than me, I was the one maybe who could best relate to the students because of our proximity in age. So sometimes that facilitated more private conversations. So being young can sometimes have an advantage.
Well, and being a woman, did that play in at all either? I'm curious.
Well, it did with the female students because they were very curious that I had, you know, been there in that capacity, in that professional position. Although, interestingly, during my visit, a lot of the interviews and tours and site visits and even visits by people to the conference area that we were holding these meetings, there were all these Iranian women wearing headphones like we're wearing right here in the studio, using directional mics to record people's opinions. So there I was with kind of this complimentary group of young Iranian women who were taking on a media function in that situation. But also there were those times, you know, the current vice president and minister for the environment, Massimo Ebtekar, ended up being sort of the the coordinator of this 10-day visit back in February 1980. And she rose to become the, you know, vice president, as I just said. But at that time, she was just instrumental in helping us understand Iran and the events that led up to the U.S. embassy takeover.
So perhaps some preconceived ideas of the role of women then and now that have perhaps changed, or you opened some eyes to that. What were some of your other experiences being there? It's just such an important historical event. And you're sitting there on the sidelines watching, observing, taking these pictures that would speak volumes.
Right. Well, you have to understand, back in 1980, the idea of Islam and the idea of revolution was very alien to Americans. And all of us, it was a delegation of 50 people plus a three-person media team, were just very surprised at this exceptional opportunity to speak person to person. I mean, that was the purpose of this group, to try and understand what led up to the takeover of the U.S. embassy. Why was it even the U.S. embassy? Why not the British or the Soviet? And in so doing, you know, we learned about what happened in the events leading up and during the revolution and why that happened. And then why in particular was it the U.S. embassy that was targeted? I mean, if you remember, just a few days prior to the takeover, the Shah was allowed entry into the United States for so-called medical treatment. And that was the trigger. For the Iranians, they wanted, one, to have him, you know, return for trial. Two, they were fearful that there would be another coup reinstalling him like they did with Mossadegh in 1953. And they also just wanted the people around the world to understand this is an affront to their politic, the affront to their way of life, that someone who had repressed their population was now getting sanctuary in the very country that had supported him for so very long. So as a 24-year-old, that definitely, most definitely, is a very eye-opening experience to really understand the complexities of our foreign policy firsthand by the people who were the subjects of that. But may I just elaborate a little more?
Please, please.
Because I think this is an important insight. So we had gone, after that first trip, journalist Bill Worthy, who was from Boston, and I had decided to apply for visas to go back at a time where American journalists had been banned from Iran, mostly because of their lack of in-depth coverage of the Iran hostage crisis. So we supposedly were granted visas. CBS News jumped at the opportunity for us to be their crew in Iran. I'm frantically trying to learn how to use a broadcast video camera and now take on a superwoman role and being, you know, a crew, you know, TV crew in Iran. But we spent approximately 2 months there interviewing high-ranking military, political, religious leaders, going through the streets, going to demonstrations. But at the end of that visit, we purchased at the University of Tehran and also at the airport a collection of books. There were like 12 in the volume at that time. And they were reprints of the very documents that had been taken when the U.S. embassy was stormed, some of which were telex, some of which were more confidential and secret. Some had been reassembled from the shredded documents that were put through the shredder, meaning those were probably the most important ones to conceal. Well, we return to the United States, get through New York City's Kennedy Airport, uneventful. But we had extra baggage that came through Logan Airport. And in that baggage was this identical set of 10 books. So the customs officials at Logan flagged it, called in the FBI, called in the CIA.
Oh, wow.
And decided to look through all our materials. They took it out of the air freight terminal, brought it back, had dogs sniff around, you know. Then when my colleague was called to pick up the materials, she was greeted by two FBI agents who said, "We were being investigated for having stolen U.S. government property, and there was a possibility of indictment."
Oh, my goodness.
Now, I'm 26 now, and I'm trying to look up the word indictment really fast, saying, what does this mean? And we realized that we might be a test case for this new theft of government property statute. So quickly, we notified CBS News that we had this identical set of books in the country. And they said, oh, you know, when asked by other media, who are these people? We were a freelance crew, and they didn't know much about us. They kind of wanted to separate themselves. But ultimately, the Washington Post decided that this was a gold mine. They put together a research team. And 2 months later, they published a front page series of articles on the contents of the books. The very same day that their series started, we announced at the Nieman Foundation at Harvard that we were suing the CIA, FBI, State Department, and customs officials for having violated our First and Fourth Amendment rights. Well, long story short, ultimately, the government realized they didn't have a case. They returned our books. We then were advised by our ACLU lawyers to file suit for damages, and we ultimately won.
Wow.
So we took a very small amount of money that we each gained, independent of what we gave to the ACLU as a donation, and got back into Iran pretty easily.
My goodness, what an interesting turn of events there. And as you said, you did return to Iran. You returned again during the war and got some wonderful pictures there and returned more recently. And though it wasn't necessarily the original focus, you did take a lot of photographs throughout this period of women in Iran, as we mentioned. And you brought one to show me today, and we're going to post it on our website. But it's a beautiful black and white picture of what looks like hundreds, possibly thousands of women in prayer. And they're guarded by female guards. This was in the 1979, I'm assuming.
No, this is 1983.
I'm sorry, 1983. Yep. And it's wonderful because there's these little kids that are popping up between their mothers. So you don't see the mothers' faces, but just these little kids popping up here and there. And it's just such a striking photo. Maybe tell us a little bit about that and what that image conjures up, and then what some more of the recent photos you've taken. What's the juxtaposition?
Sure. Well, this is a black and white image, as you said, and it is just a view, a lengthy, distant view of all these women at prayer. And as it was the wartime, the Revolutionary Guards were there to perhaps get the assembled out of the area quickly. I mean, missiles hadn't fallen on Iran, on Tehran. In the south it had, but not in Tehran as much. But in the event of, people were ready to kind of move out quickly.
And it's female guards, and that was part of the course. That was quite normal.
Yes. Oh, yeah, there were female Revolutionary Guards. When you went into any government building, you'd be patted down, you know, privately in a tented area, you know, by the Revolutionary Guards to make sure, you know, there were security people, in a sense, and the privacy as well. But then, so this was outdoors at the University of Tehran, immediately in front of the staging where political and religious speeches would go on every Friday, were the men. And the women were kind of cordoned off into the side areas going down like long corridors, etc. But then when I went back, going to see what had since transpired about attendance, about location, it was one of those, I want to go back and revisit kind of themes in my 2015 trip. So I went to what's now this massive, soon to be perhaps the largest mosque, if completed in the future, with a separate area for men and women. I mean, again, the men in the thousands are in front of this new, beautifully, magnificently mosaic-laden staged area, and the women are up above. And what's interesting is while you often think of women in the Middle East who are wearing a chador, wearing black chadors, this time there was such variation of color and design and, you know, fabrics and lightness to it. And it was just kind of a magnificently beautiful sight to see. But, you know, things have really changed in Iran, and this one little example might show that. So as I navigated through these bodies of bodies. And there was one time where the crowds were invoked to chant, you know, something that is a kind of an anti-Western phrase, Magbar Amrika. It's translated as down with America, death to America, whatever, you know, if you want to use on that one. But it was said, you know, kind of as a way to people to be joined in together politically. But at that time, the young woman who had been assigned to me to kind of help me navigate through all this turned to me, and she knew I was from the United States, and she said, I'm really sorry that you have to hear that. It's not what we mean. We don't mean death to America. We mean that we are against the United States policy towards Iran at this time. And this was right in the approach to the signing of the nuclear agreement. So to me, that had even more meaning that she would, you know, identify that this is something that was important and meaningful to her.
Well, perhaps you could describe a couple of the more recent photos. You said there's a lot of color. Are there any favorites?
Yeah, for sure. One thing that was really striking to me when you go into the subways more prominently than anywhere else, perhaps because the subways do have this gender segregation that's optional. If you want, as a woman, to stay in a car with only women, you can go in the first or the last car. If it doesn't matter to you, you just go into any other car. So I decided to play kind of like hopscotch. I'd go into the gender exclusive car of women and then go back into the other one. And then also on the buses, you know, women and men are in separate areas. But the women are just extraordinarily striking and modern in their dress and in their makeup and in their hair color and where they wear their headscarves. This was a tremendously obvious transformation. Number of women had done surgically corrected their the shape of their noses. That's very popular in Iran and also a lot of other Middle East countries, but I think the surgeons in Iran are kind of noted for it. So to walk around with a bandaged nose became a status symbol.
Oh,
right. But women would wear, you know, makeup. I never saw that as kind of being something that, you know, was totally rejected. Often when women were in the north of Tehran, which is the more upper class area, their scarves would hang far towards the back of their head or sometimes just around their shoulders if they were driving. I mean, you know, there are, you know, things, there are objections to those kinds of positionings of the scarf. But it seemed as though women were feeling, you know, as time has gone on, that there's a pushback and that, you know, maybe this represents for them saying, you know, it's our time. You know, we've waited long enough. We really got to get back into the game, and that there's a lot that we need to do. So,
thank you so much for sharing your amazing experiences with us, and certainly for sharing your beautiful work.
Thank you. Thanks, Rebecca.
You've been listening to a conversation with photojournalist Randy Goodman. She spoke with my colleague, Rebecca Cruz. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced this show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gorlott.